When you're acting as your doodle's teacher during training, do you know their learning style? Take our exclusive fun and free quiz to find out at thedoodlepro.com/learning and make training more fun and successful.
Before we start this episode, I just must give a shout out to the most recent review on Apple Podcasts. This is by Clobug99, who said, "This podcast has a lot of tips. I have an adorable golden doodle, and these tips help. I tell my parents all of them because I'm 9. This helps my puppy, whose name is Charlie." Clobug99, I am so happy to hear from you. I have a 10-year-old boy named Gavin, and him and I talk about training all the time. Your golden doodle, Charlie, is lucky to have you. If you would like a shout out on the Doodle Pro podcast, be sure to leave a review on your favorite streaming service. Thank you, Clobug.
Doodle breed dogs are easy to love, but can be challenging to parent. I'm doodle expert Corinne Gearhart, also known as the Doodle Pro, and I'm here to help doodle parents have a more fulfilling and rewarding experience with their doodles. No one has professionally worked with as many different doodle breeds or has more experience with doodles than I have, and I love to share my expertise in a fun, compassionate, and non-judgmental way. From my years of work and education in the pet care and dog training industry, I have an incredible network of skilled training, grooming, and veterinary professionals to share their knowledge with you and give you the doodle-specific answers you're looking for. I hope you enjoy today's episode as I help you parent your doodle like a pro.
Before we start this episode, I just must give a shout out to the most recent review on Apple Podcasts. This is by Clobug99, who said, "This podcast has a lot of tips. I have an adorable golden doodle, and these tips help. I tell my parents all of them because I'm 9. This helps my puppy, whose name is Charlie." Clobug99, I am so happy to hear from you. I have a 10-year-old boy named Gavin, and him and I talk about training all the time. Your golden doodle, Charlie, is lucky to have you. If you would like a shout out on the Doodle Pro podcast, be sure to leave a review on your favorite streaming service. Thank you, Clobug. I'm so happy to have Victoria Baker back with us. She met with us for a previous episode discussing why your dog is reactive when on walks, if your dog is barking, lunging, or hiding. And today she's going to tell us what to do about it, how to help our dog through this so that walks can be more pleasant for you and for them. Welcome, Victoria.
Hello, how are you?
Wonderful. So when I define reactivity in my mind, it just means a larger reaction than is usually expected for that situation. And it could be hiding. It doesn't have to be loud, but it could be tail tucked, but just a bigger reaction to a stimulus that another dog might be okay with. How would you define reactivity on walks?
If you can tell that the dog is anxious or fearful or just not comfortable, then that's reactivity. You want the dog to feel happy, safe, not afraid of novel stimuli when they're outside and that kind of stuff. And anything less than that is actually reactivity. So,
excellent. And we're going to discuss the two reasons why a dog might be barking or showing reactivity or hiding while you're on a walk. You discussed this in our previous episode, that the two motivating factors can be distress, where they have fear or anxiety about what they're seeing and they're trying to create distance. And then eustress is when they have an overexcitement and want to get to whatever it is they see, another dog that they want to play with or another human that they like across the street. So we're going to first go over the more common reason, which is the fear, anxiety, and trying to create distance.
Yeah, and a lot of the techniques using the fear reactivity also translates to the frustrated greeter as well.
Great.
So whenever you're working with fear, we want to start with the dog where the dog feels safe. And it's not up to the human to determine that. So we go back to the other podcast. We discussed a little bit about body language and how to read your dog's signs of stress, anxiety, and fear. And so that's kind of part of it. At the same time, while you're going to work on counter conditioning how your dog feels about a certain trigger, the more your dog knows how to do stuff for you, or that you can be instructional and your dog understands, will elevate the dog's confidence. And that's really all we're working with here, is making the dog feel confident and safe. So I'm not going to go over these things, but at the same time, you can teach your dogs how to target, how to walk on a leash, how to heel, how to sit in front of you, and how to look at you. So for those emergency situations where your dog's just not quite prepared for it, you can actually distract the dog with other alternative behaviors. They don't always have to have it done. You can do it at the same time, and it's totally different than treating the fear. So the first thing you want to do when you're working with the dog is to load a marker. So a marker is a sound that tells the dog what it did when it heard that sound was something super, and it just earned a reward. Okay. And to load a marker, you just make that sound and you follow with a treat. Now you want to make sure that you make the sound and you pause and then give the treat, because you don't want your hand movement to anticipate the treat. You want the sound. We can mess that up really easy by doing it at the same time. You make the sound and you give the treat. So I use a clicker, but you don't have to use a clicker. You can use a verbal marker. When you pick a verbal marker, and I would always load a verbal marker as well, because you're not always going to have a clicker, I pick sounds that I don't normally say in the English language, and I don't like to use words that infer praise either. It's not a reinforcer. So I don't like to use yes or good, but a lot of trainers do. Doesn't really matter, as long as the sound is crisp and consistent. So your inflection doesn't constantly change. The other thing, besides teaching basic skills of leash, targeting, and being able to loading the marker, you also want to desensitize the leash, because when the leash goes tight, when you're out on a walk, the dog gets aroused no matter what. Whatever state of mind he's in, as soon as he feels that restraint, it's going to increase it. So if he's fearful, you're going to increase that fear. If he's feeling aggressive, you're going to increase that. So you want to desensitize the leash, and you should look at the leash instead of a form of restraint as a form of communication. And so the leash should be loose, unless you're trying to communicate with the dog in some way. So when the leash goes tight, you have the clip of the leash, and the clip of the leash is hanging when the leash is loose and in a J. When the leash goes tight, that clip starts to go up. And that's an indication to the dog that it's losing its handler, not an indication that the handler is trying to jerk him around somewhere. It's just, hey, my handler took two steps to the left. I took a step to the right. The leash is starting to go tight. I better check in to see where he's going, because I want to follow.
What's key about this, Victoria, is you are not using the leash to make what people call corrections.
No.
So that would be different if somebody had been taught to pop the leash and tug it really fast to tell their dog that they're doing something wrong. We want a different relationship with our dog and a different relationship with the leash and collar than that.
Sit and stay right there. We'll be back right after this quick break.
Dog's body language is a foreign language to us humans. Are you wondering how fluent you are? Take our free quiz at thedoodlepro.com/body and find out how fluent you are in reading dog's body language.
It's a form of communication,
yes,
not restraint. When I'm working with the dog, the only time the leash goes tight is when the dog makes the leash go tight. And then I'm more like a brick wall, right? the leash is attached to me and there's a certain length of the leash. And I teach the dog when that leash goes tight to move into that pressure versus away. And we spend a lot of time on that because when the dog doesn't feel like it's being held back, then the dog's arousal stays at an even level. And when the dog's arousal is low, you're not having reactivity. So really, we're always working with arousal levels. So we want to do whatever it takes to bring the arousal level down. And it helps to walk on a front clip harness. It helps to have a relaxed handler who's not tense with that leash. Because as soon as you tense up that leash, your shoulders get tight. And you don't even realize how you're holding your breath. You don't even realize how tense you are as soon as you see the trigger. And the dogs train us to be just as reactive as them as well. So I spend a lot of time on little exercises saying, oh, we have a little leash pressure to the right. You go to the right. You get a mark and a treat as soon as you give in to that leash pressure. So that when I feel that pressure, it doesn't anticipate anything except for, hey, I might get a treat and I should follow my handler.
That is before they're seeing the triggers. You're laying that foundation before any reactivity is starting.
No. Hey. When you're training reactivity, the reactivity never starts.
Beautiful.
Guys, reactivity training, like true reactivity training, is boring. Nothing's happening. Everybody's happy. Everybody feels safe. The dog's getting treats and there's no barking, lunging, growling. Once you have the barking, lunging, growling, you're too late. You missed your opportunity to do any training.
Yes, so, they're out of their training brain space.
They're in survival mode and that's it. So that's another thing. When we went over the other podcast, we discussed when dogs visualize something or see something as a threat, it's going to kill them. There's no gray area. Oh, it's just a minor threat. It's not a big deal. They're just going to steal my money. They're not going to bite me. No, all dogs are going to bite you. They're knife wielding mouths full of knives and razors that are going to kill me. And that's how the dog views it. So if you think about that while you're out on walks can be pretty scary for a dog who's fearful of people or dogs or scooters or bikes or cars, any of those things, and induce that primal reaction where they go back to their instincts. And when a dog is scared, doesn't know what to do, they lunge, bark, growl, and bite.
Especially if they're feeling that restraint from us tightening the leash.
Right.
Because now they know they can't escape.
Correct.
Yeah.
So I spend a lot of time working that leash pressure and it's real easy. No distractions. You just, the leash goes tight, you move, you get a click and a treat. Over and over again. So that when that leash goes tight, the dog's like, oh, it's tight. What do you do? Okay. So those are things that you work on continuously. But the real crux of helping the dog get over its fears is counter conditioning, how they feel about a certain trigger. Mm-hmm. And there's a few protocols that I use for that. So I use BAT, which was developed by Grisha Stewart, which is behavioral adjustment training, where I put the dog on a longer leash where they feel they have some autonomy over what happens to them. So they're not like feeling like they're tied to a tree.
Yeah.
And they are able to make choices. So when you're far enough away, when a dog is nervous of something out in the distance, the first thing a dog does is put their nose down and go in the other direction. Not a whole, like 10 feet in the other direction, but their nose is down. And that accomplishes telling the dog in the distance or the person in the distance that dog's not a threat. Yeah. And it also puts them in a different place in their mind. The olfactory portion of their brain lights up. It lowers arousal and they get out of that primal reactive brain and they get into more of the thinking brain. You're also letting the dog make a choice. We set up the dogs and we make them go towards each other and we never stop because we have to get from A to Z in a certain amount of time frame. And the dog's just not ready to move forward yet. It needs to assess the situation to determine whether or not dog's a threat. Just by putting a dog on a longer leash and respecting his choices from a distance that he feels safe, a lot of times takes care of the reactivity.
I know both you and I love our biothane kind of thin, longer leads. Like, it's just wonderful to handle. You can wash them easy.
Yeah. They don't get snagged and they don't get any heavier. Mm-hmm. All of that stuff. So counter conditioning is changing a dog's emotional response to seeing a trigger from, oh my God, it's going to kill me, to, hey, I'm going to get a treat. And that's all it is. And the only way that can happen is if it happens below threshold. Knowing your dog's body language, if a dog can't take a treat, if the dog's ears go back or the tail gets tucked or the hackles go up or the tail goes straight up and curled and it's like this.
Yes.
He's at threshold, right? Mm-hmm. Next thing to go is lunge bark, and you don't want to go to that point. So you want to back it up just a little bit and let the dog feel safe. And where a lot of trainers disagree or have a different way of training, I like to mark the dog. So marking tells the dog that it did something good.
Yes.
When it looks at the trigger. And if you have a really short triggered dog, and you want to get it before the dog starts a reaction, right? You want to get it before he feels stress. And sometimes the dogs will trigger off a smell before they actually see the trigger. So if that happens, I will mark an ear twitch, because that gives me an indication that he knows something's in his presence and he wants to keep an eye on it. Or I will mark the nose in the air before the look if I have a quick triggered dog.
I was just saying, as for listeners who are multitasking, I would say come back and listen to this, because what Victoria is telling you is likely different than you might have heard on a YouTube video or some neighborhood trainer. Victoria is telling you like the next level advice of when the dog is looking at the thing that can cause reactivity or fear or anxiety. She is delivering that treat when they're seeing that animal, or whatever it is that they're nervous about.
Marking it, because I can be Johnny on the spot with the marker.
Yes, thank you.
And the marker actually relaxes the dog, because the dog always knows, whoa, I did something good, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas your voice, if you say something, has an inflection in it. And the dog knows exactly what's going on in your head.
And what people are told differently is they give a command or a cue and then mark and reward the dog to turn away and turn their back on the thing that they think is going to kill them.
And that creates more stress. I don't want the trigger to induce a feeling in the dog that they have to perform for their owners, because that adds more stress to the dog. Just want it happy. I see the dog, I get the mark, and the mark tells me, ooh, I did something good. All I got to do is look. I don't have to do anything. I don't have to protect you. I don't have to bark. I don't have to lunge. I don't have to do anything except look at the dog. And then that earns me a reward, and it helps them relax, and it's consistent. And you want to do it every single time, because if you're only doing it 1 out of 10 times out on a walk, don't bother, because they're practicing what you don't want 9 out of 10 times. That's not going to change behavior. So as soon as the dog looks, you mark. And I'm saying, you got to be Johnny on the spot with this. If you're 2 seconds late, you're going to lose your dog, because if your dog fixates for 2 seconds, that's it. They're going to go into their instinctual mode of reactivity that they've practiced a lot. And you've lost your dog. And once your dog starts to bark and lunge, you're done. You're done, and you have to remove yourself and start over. You take that newspaper, roll it up, and beat yourself in the head with it and say, what can I do better next time? You just messed it up. And that's okay. You're going to mess it up, because it takes some skill and intuitiveness to know how to read your dog. And you got to manage the marker, you got to manage the treats, you got to manage the leash.
There's mechanics involved that
you have to understand. You've got to be hyper-vigilant about your environment, right? You know, we can only concentrate on 1 or 2 things at a time. So don't beat yourself up if you mess it up. It's fine. Just take a note do better next time. All right. So the dog looks, you mark, and then you treat. Now, the first couple of times you do this, the dog is not going to know the game. So the dog's not going to look to get treat when it hears the mark because it hasn't played the game. So you stick that food right up that dog's nose and it should be stinky meat, real meat treats, you know, something the dog.
No really, dry biscuits here. No.
Really salivates for. You stick it right up his nose and you turn that dog's head, bring that treat to the ground so that he has to sniff to pick it up. It makes him look away from the dog. We're not distracting him from the dog. We're just letting him enjoy his treat without staring at the dog. Because if you give the treat while he's staring at the dog, then he's threatening the dog while he's eating the treat. And it just increases arousal. He doesn't even know he's eating the treat. Okay, so you have to move his gaze away from the dog, put the treat on the ground. You can throw it. You can hit him in the head. You can throw it right in between the eyes. You can stick it right up the nose. Whatever. He needs to look away immediately, less than 2 seconds. And you have that much time to make it work. And you got to catch the very first instant that he looks. And what this does is it lowers arousal while he eats the treat, but it gives him an opportunity to look at the trigger again. And you're going to mark the second he looks at the trigger. And sometimes that's he's eyeballing it as he's turning away from the treat. And you're going to mark and do it again. A dog comes into the environment and into threshold. So let's say the dog's threshold is across the street. Right? So the dog's like a half a block up across the street. And you're like, all right, he looks at the dog. You're going to mark it, put the treat on the ground. He's going to look away, get the treat, and he's going to look again. You're going to mark, look, mark, treat, look, mark, treat, look, mark, treat, look, mark, treat, until the dog walks by you and is out of threshold again, which is around 40 to 60 feet. Okay. And then no more food.
The bar is closed until the next dog. Yep.
Then it helps me to put me in the right state of mind to talk to the dog, to tell him, hey, we love dogs. Oh, my God. All you have to do is look at the dog and you get a treat. Oh, you're such a good dog. You want to be really happy when you see another dog. And you want to expect your dog to look at the dog and look away and look at the dog and look away. And that's what you should be visualizing when you're giving the dog a treat instead of going, please don't bark. Just don't pull. Just don't lunge this time.
I know the fear of embarrassment.
Don't say those things in your head because whatever you visualize, you're more likely to get. So you want to visualize what you want. Okay. So the best scenario when you do this in the beginning, especially, is if you can control the environment. So it helps to have a decoy person with the dog that will stop walking towards you if your dog starts to go ballistic. So, you know, you don't always have that. And that's one reason why you have to hire trainers, because trainers set those scenarios up for you so that the dog is successful and control the environment. But there are certain places you can go where you can predict the dog's going to come every 5-10 minutes on a leash.
Yeah.
See him coming from a mile away. So they're not surprising you from behind, from 10 feet and that kind of thing. So the best scenario is to go out and do these kinds of exercises for about 10 to 15 minutes and two or three dogs. And they come at you in about 1 to 2 minute intervals. And that's it. So the dog appears, the dog comes within threshold, and you're reading your body language to determine that. Look, mark, treat, look, mark, treat, look, mark, treat, look, mark, treat. And I am not exaggerating how fast that should be. I really mean look, mark, treat, look, mark, treat. He should, like, in the 20 seconds that it takes a dog to walk by, that dog should get 10 treats.
We're not trying to be stingy here.
No stinginess.
We're asking for expensive behavior. We need to pay accordingly.
More is better. If you're in doubt, give a treat. And then people are going to ask too, what if my dog is barking? and I missed it. I don't care. You're not going to reinforce the bark. The dog's not barking to get a treat. The dog is barking because it wants to gain distance from the dog that's coming at him. He's barking to get you to do something different.
Move away. Yes.
So you're not going to reinforce the bark. And a lot of times the food in that instance isn't going to counter condition the dog, but it's going to at least lower arousal if you can get the dog's nose down to the ground to take the treat. And when that happens too, when the dog starts to bark like that, I use the treat to be able to walk away 10 feet on a loose leash. So the leash never goes tight. And then I can reset the dog outside of threshold and try.
So doing
again.
An emergency U-turn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And try again. And it's like, okay, let's take a little quick little breather and then come back and try it again. In this instance, we're not training behavior. We are counter conditioning an emotional state versus reinforcing a sit or a look at me or a heel. We're just pairing good stuff with scary trigger so that we can actually change scary trigger to yay, good stuff.
And if you have really good stuff, it's soft, it's stinky, it's small, like really good stuff. And you think that your dog hasn't reached their threshold and you're trying to deliver the treats and the dog's refusing it.
You're past threshold. If the dog can't take a treat.
Yep. They're too
stressed
for
it. It's a good indicator as I've done too much. And then, so dogs come by, look mark treat, look mark treat, look mark treat. Dog goes away, no more food. Another minute goes by, da 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 da. We're just hanging out, we're walking. Oh, here comes another dog. Look mark treat, look mark treat, look mark treat, look mark treat. No more food. Da 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 da. Life is good. My owner is insanely happy. I don't know why he's giving me all these treats. And the next dog shows up, look mark treat, look mark treat. He's not looking as much anymore because he's starting to get the game. All I have to do is look. And every time I see my trigger, I get food. He's starting to relax now. And it usually takes about 3 to 5 times of a dog who is paying attention to its handler, is just outside of threshold, and isn't trying to get closer to the dog in question. The dog that we're training. That's an easy scenario. So once the dog starts looking and then looking back at you or faking the look, you've won the game with that particular distraction. Dog that's walking along across the street, paying attention to its handler is a lot easier for the dog to handle than a dog that's staring at him, pulling and lunging and barking at him. And on the same side of the road. So you have to work all those kinds of different scenarios. And when the dog realizes, so behavioral adjustment training with the long line, honoring the dog's good choices that it makes to avoid a situation that it doesn't want to be reactive in, right? It helps the dog know that you understand what he needs in a given moment to feel safe. And when a dog can trust their human to feel safe, they start to relax a little, that they don't have to go crazy at the end of the leash to announce to the entire world that I'm not comfortable. Right?
Yes.
My owner's got it, man. He gives me enough space and makes me feel safe and then pairs everything with food and it's really consistent. It happens every single time. Now I don't have to worry about taking things into my own hands. And the dog's cortisol levels literally plummet once they realize that kind of stuff.
And what Victoria just said there is really important, of the dog knowing that you've got their back and you're giving them that space, you're giving them choice. And to me, that means I don't walk up to my friend when they're walking their dog and bring my dog up to them. When I'm socializing with my neighbor, I am not able to multitask enough, even as a pro, to see my dog's subtle cues of whether or not they're comfortable. And they are tethered to me with a leash and they aren't given that full choice. So I always give a bubble for my dog when we're on walks. And even when I owned my dog walking company, it was our hard and fast rule that we don't greet other dogs on leash. What are your thoughts?
So No, there's no reason to greet a strange dog on leash. You don't know what that dog's all about. And you can't trust people.
Sound like no, a true dog trainer.
No, he's not. He's.
We all have different. We all have different definitions.
You're just an idiot. No, be rude. If it is a neighbor that really wants to talk to you and communicate something important to you, just tell him you'll call him.
Yes.
Or you'll text him and after I'm done walking the dog. But yeah, don't be nice. And that can be really hard for people.
It is hard. I do the outstretched hand.
No, not right now. I've got to go. I'm training. I'll call you.
I always say we're in training because we are. We every day. It's not a one and done. Every day we are training.
Every interaction is a training interaction, whether you like it or not.
So if that's starting to work, your dog's starting to look over and check in, you're starting to win this game. How long does this game go on?
It's different for every dog. Sometimes when they realize that they can actually make a choice and that you understand why he's making that choice and you make it with them and he feels safe, sometimes that's enough to turn it around in one session. It's just a different perspective of how the dog sees the walk. Other dogs have a genuine fear of other dogs that takes a systematic process in order to change how that dog feels about that fear. If you're afraid of heights, I'm not going to go out in one session and put you at the edge of a cliff and say, okay, you're good. You are safe. Nothing happened. So it takes a systematic process and you can't go too fast. And every time that dog has a reactive event, the cortisol levels go up. It takes days to come back down. When you're chatter conditioning, you're rewiring the neural pathways in the brain to go somewhere else. And every time that neural pathway gets rewritten into reactivity, you've taken a step back. And now you've got to just breathe. You'll take two steps forward, one step back. And some dogs, it goes really quickly because they don't actually, they're not afraid of dogs. They're just afraid of a strange dog that they don't know might hurt them. But they actually love dogs. And that's 90% of the dogs that are out there. The ones that have the genuine, I'm scared to death of every dog I see or every person, are the ones that have been not socialized at all, neglected, or seriously abused, especially during that development period of 4 to 16 weeks.
A lot of pet parents are in a hurry to leave the treat bag at home or to retire it quickly. So when we're saying how long it takes, how long should someone be bringing their treats?
Yeah, I don't understand that. Maybe you can give me a good reason why people don't want to reinforce their dogs. Maybe I'll understand that. But when my dog does something that doesn't come naturally to a dog, that's overcome a tremendous amount of fear, is a dog that people go, oh my God, you have such a well-trained dog. And I'm like, yeah, I know. I want to be able to reward my dog in a meaningful way. And praise usually doesn't cut it for the dog.
So if a dog is starting to check in, how much longer are we using treats to reinforce
that particular context? Don't have to keep giving treats just for looking at the dog. Now you can ask for more behavior. Now you can say, okay, we're going to heal. Okay, we're going to do this. And you can do other things because the dog's not worried about whether or not he's going to die. You can forego the look, mark, treat, look, mark, treat, look, mark, treat now and be instructional and say, heal. And then you can reward him for heal. And then you can work on progressing your duration of how long he can heal for before he needs the reinforcement for feedback to continue to heal.
Yeah.
So it just, more is better. You have to think, how long has your dog been reactive? It's been years. Then you're going to be doing this for a long time. If it's only been since he became an adolescent, he was happy go lefty dog and then has a fear period during adolescence and he's 8 months old and he's losing his puppy, it might happen in one session. I have had that happen before.
And Victoria's method that she's walking you through counts for people on bicycles, the neighbor who walks with a cane, the trash cans on trash day. It's not only seeing another dog. It's for whatever they are feeling big feelings about.
Yeah, whatever the trigger is, be multiple triggers. And it's best not to work multiple triggers together. You want to work them individually before you start putting them together as well. So if the dog is afraid of people and dogs, you really want to work people first before you start bringing in the dogs.
When you're separating those triggers, you'd be using management to create distance, not letting them practice and forcing them to be around dogs, trash cans, whatever, while you're working on the other trigger.
Yeah, you're controlling the environment so they're not experiencing those distractions until they're ready to be worked or trained. And that's hard. Having a reactive dog is hard. There's no doubt. The process of getting them over it is actually very easy.
And it's doable.
Yeah, it's really, it's easy. It's timing. And we mess the timing up because we wait until the dog looks away from the dog and we reward the dog for looking at us instead of looking at the dog. So now the food has no correlation to counter conditioning the trigger. It's only reinforcing looking at me. And that's not what I really want to reinforce. I want to pair good stuff with the scary thing. I don't want the dog to think that it's getting rewarded for a scent. I want the dog to know the other dog is why he's getting rewarded.
Yes, so, I think that is the key to this.
Yeah, and timing is very important. And you can mess up the timing too. And you can make food predict dog. And then again, the food isn't going to do anything to counter condition that emotional response. So you want to make sure dog predicts food. So that's why you wait until the dog knows that there's a presence there, looks at the presence mark, and then treat and put the treat on the ground. And again, you asked how long. So you start out with an easy dog. I always start out with my dog because my dog's perfect. My dog just lays there and she doesn't elicit bad responses from dogs because she's very non-threatening. She doesn't care about the other dog. That's what you want to start with, right?
Yes.
Or a dog that's walking happily, paying attention to its handlers, not a big threat to another dog. That's your next step. And a moving dog is harder to deal with than a stationary dog. And if both dogs are moving, that's harder to deal with than if one dog is stationary and one dog is moving. And you need to do that. Like in one session, I will have the dog I'm working with be stationary and I'll have the decoy dog walk by. And then we'll do that a couple of times. And then I'll switch it. I'll have the decoy dog stationary and I will walk by with the reactive dog. And then we'll do that a few times. And then we'll have both dogs moving.
And if you think of what our dogs are usually encountering, almost always we're both moving.
Always. And always moving right at each other on the same side.
Yes.
COVID was so nice.
It was.
Because people would automatically cross the street for you. And reactive dogs had a little breather.
Yeah. It was like the best thing for them. Yes, we all had these bubbles by default. There was no social pressure of, oh, I hope we make it past them.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you know, there are exceptions, right? There are dogs that they can see a dog from 500 yards away and they'll still go crazy. And I work with dogs like that. I just have a little bit different protocol. And honestly, I just don't think that's a protocol that a lay person should try and do without some sort of guidance from a trainer.
Join us on episode 26 to hear the rest of my conversation with Victoria. She is going to share her protocol for how to work with what she calls frustrated greeters and how to help your doodle who is barking at passerbys, either in the house or outside of your house. Thanks for joining me on this episode of the Doodle Pro Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. And I invite you to follow me on Instagram at TheDoodlePro for behind-the-scenes peeks at all of the adorable doodles I work with daily.